The views and opinions expressed in Cold and Missing are exclusively those of the hosts. All parties mentioned are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Cold and Missing also contains adult themes and languages. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm your host, Allie McLaughlin-Sulkowski.
And I'm your co-host, Eli Sulkowski.
And this is Cold and Missing, where we cover cold cases
and missing person cases.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Cold and Missing. I'm your host, Allie.
And I'm your co-host, Eli. Welcome back, everyone.
Thank you, as always, for your patience with us. I know we were off again kind of unexpectedly last week. Our dog has been going through some health stuff, and he had surgery last week, but he's doing better. He's almost back to his normal self. So thank you all so much for the kind wishes and positivity that still came through. Like, we still got some great reviews over this last week. So thank you all so much for sticking with us and coming back for another case.
And with that, we are on episode 133 this week.
And we are on a cold case. So should we just go ahead and get into it?
Let's do it.
Today, we are talking about the cold cases of Grover Cecil, Joyce Reason, and Johnny Rankins, otherwise known as the Below Murders. And this takes place in June of 1993 in Windsor, North Carolina. But first, a little bit about Johnny, Joyce, and Grover. Johnny Rankins, he is 48 years old in 1993 and lived in nearby Edenton. I could find very little details about him, but we do know that he worked on the cleaning crew. Joyce Reason is 36 years old in 1993. She was a single mother to two young girls, and she was also engaged, and the wedding was planned for later that summer. She worked as a cashier at the Below grocery store. And Grover Cecil, he went by the family name of Bud. He was 47 years old in 1993 and was the store manager of the Below, a position that was newer to him as he had only been the manager for a few months. He was married and a father. And now, a timeline of events. Sunday, June 6th, 1993. It was nearing closing time at the Below grocery store. The grocery store is located in Windsor, North Carolina. It's a small community with a population of around 2,400. The employees are busy trying to get closing cleaning done and helping the last few customers check out. As it neared the 6 p.m. closing time, the overnight cleaning crew was starting to show up and gather their supplies. Since it was Sunday, there was a plan to clean and wax the floors. The cleaning crew consisted of four guys: Johnny Rankins, Thomas Hardy, Jasper Hardy, and Sylvester Welch. 6 p.m. came and the last customers left. The doors were locked and most of the employees had left for the evening. Two employees remained: Joyce Reason, a cashier, and Grover Cecil, the manager. A few minutes after six, Jasper, a member of the cleaning crew, looked up and saw Joyce and Grover walking towards them with a strange look on their face. Behind them was a man that Jasper had never seen before. He's described as a black man in his 20s or 30s, around 6 foot tall, slender with medium complexion. His nose had a noticeable bump, like he had had an injury to it prior. The man had hidden in the store and waited until the doors were locked before approaching Grover first with a gun. The man had the gun to Grover's back. Grover tells the cleaning crew, quote, "Do what he says. He means business." The gunman seemed at ease and even seemed to anticipate how many men were part of the cleaning crew. He asked where one of them was when he only encountered three of them, according to reports. The gunman is able to get all four members of the cleaning crew and Joyce and Grover to the back of the store near the meat counter very quickly. The man gathers cash and money orders from the store. He ordered the hostages to bind each other up at the wrists and ankles using duct tape and dog leashes that he had found in the store. Grover was ordered to bind the hands of the rest of the hostages, and then the gunman bound Grover's hands. Once everyone was tied up, the gunman had the hostages lay down and put them into three piles of two, so they were lying on top of each other. Jasper, one of the cleaning crew members, thought everybody was going to be okay. Everyone was complying with the gunman. Jasper said that the man kept saying, quote, "I don't want to have to kill anybody." He also kept promising that no one would get hurt as long as they followed orders. He also told the hostages that he used to be a police officer and he had been fired from his job. He didn't have anything left to lose. Jasper was lying on the floor with another person on top of him. He was laying with his face turned toward the wall and was praying for the ordeal to be over. Then, suddenly, the man fired a bullet into each pile. Jasper said, quote, "I heard the shots, pop, pop, pop. Sometimes there would be a grunt when someone was hit. I just lay there and prayed harder than I ever prayed in my life." It appears that when the man went to fire a fourth time, the gun jammed or he ran out of ammunition. The gunman then rolls each victim onto the stomach and leaves them on the floor. He leaves for a couple minutes and returns with a knife that he had found. The gunman approached Jasper and his brother Thomas. He asked them if they would identify him. Thomas told him no, to which the man shouted, quote, "I don't believe you." Jasper was still lying facing the wall, so he didn't see the gunman approach his brother and stab him. Thomas is violently attacked. His throat is slit and the butcher knife breaks off in his back. The gunman then approached Jasper and asks him as well, quote, "Will you identify me?" To which Jasper responds, quote, "No, man, I don't know you." The man then replies, quote, "Okay, big man, I'll let you live." Jasper waited. He didn't believe the man and he thought he would be attacked next. But the man doesn't attack him. He gathers up the money, a little over $3,000 in cash and money orders, and places them into a grocery bag along with keys to the store and heads out the door. Jasper was alive and unhurt, but still bound. Sylvester Welch and Thomas Hardy were also clinging to life. Thomas had been stabbed and Sylvester had been shot in the back. Sylvester is able to free himself from the binds and drag himself to the office and call 911. The phone call comes in at 6:56 p.m. When police enter the Belo grocery store, they find Sylvester in the front office, but everyone else were in bloody piles in the back rear corner of the store. A first responder said, quote, "I remember the smell of blood. There was blood everywhere." Sylvester Welch and Thomas Hardy are still alive but in critical condition. They are rushed to Pitt Memorial Hospital in Greenville. Johnny Rankins, Joyce Reason, and Grover Cecil are all dead inside of the Belo. Jasper Harding was left unhurt and is able to provide police with details from the terrible night. Police begin combing the scene. We know they find two spent casings from a .45 caliber pistol. As more police gather at the Belo, neighbors start to come out. A man who was visiting his girlfriend who lived across the street from the Belo, and they were both home during the attacks, they said they didn't hear anything. Witnesses tell police that they saw a white car with Maryland license plates speeding north on US 17 after the shooting. The next day, Monday, June 7th, 1993, Thomas, who was stabbed, is still listed in critical condition, while Sylvester, who had been shot, was in a serious condition, according to the hospital. The brutal slaying sent shockwaves through the small community. Police say that they saw an uptick in applications for concealed carry the very next day. Jasper, who walked away unhurt, says, quote, "It was only the mercy of God that spared me. I said a lot of things to God while I was laying on the floor, and you can believe I planned to stick to every one of them." Police are still working their way through the crime scene. Sheriff Perry believes that the gunman might have piled the victims up so that one shot would kill two people. Police say, quote, "We think he may have been low on ammunition. Only in military executions have I heard of it. I've never heard of it in a robbery. I've heard of the enemy stacking our soldiers and killing them this way." Jasper is on edge. He says, quote, "I'm still afraid. I'm afraid for myself, but I'm more afraid for my wife. I hope to God they catch him. But if he does come here, I'll be ready." Local police are able to rule out all former officers for their departments, so they send out an alert to other departments in the state and other states to see if any recently fired officers fit the description of the gunman. On Tuesday, June 8th, 2 days after the murder, police tell media that there may have been a second man involved in the crime. Sheriff Perry tells media that the white car that was seen speeding north after the murder was also seen in the parking lot just before the killings took place. A man was seen waiting in the car in the parking lot, and then two men were seen in the car when it was speeding north. The second person is described as a black man with a darker complexion. He would have been between 6 foot and 6 foot two, in his mid-30s, and was described as being very muscular. Police are still at the Belo combing through the store in search of more evidence. Altogether, $3,324 was stolen from the store. On Wednesday, June 9th, it's been 3 days since the murder, and there is some good news. Thomas and Sylvester are doing better. Their condition is upgraded to fair, and they are healing. Investigators are still sorting through officers who had been fired from other departments. But investigators also wonder if he really was a police officer. Sheriff Perry says, quote, "It is an unusual gun for a police officer to be carrying. It leaves a nasty hole." At this time, most police officers would carry a 9mm pistol, or older officers would sometimes carry a .357 revolver. However, the casings that were picked up at the store were from a .45 caliber pistol. Police don't think that he knew the victims. They believe he was an outsider, and investigators alerted Maryland authorities due to the license plate seen on the white car. Police continue to investigate, but the updates slow down. The next one comes in November of 1993, so it's been 5 months since the murders, and the FBI have gotten involved along with the State Bureau of Investigation. The FBI have created a profile of the suspect, and they release it to the public. They believe that the gunman would be a threat to his family and friends because of the stress he is under. They believe that this is not the first time that he is killed, and that he has likely served time in the past on felony charges of some kind. While in prison, he likely thrived and was a model inmate. He could have even found religion there. He would be very manipulative. They believe that he could convince anyone of almost anything. The FBI say, quote, "Think back to Memorial Day. Who came to this area for a visit? Who came to this area for a funeral? We are asking that anyone who knows this person to please give us a call." The reward for information has grown to $30,000. Over the next year, police continue to work on the case, and they even create a task force. But still, in June of 1994, so a year since the murders, there's no suspect in the case, and the Belo has closed down. Investigators strongly believe that the killer likely has had or is in a relationship with a woman who lives in the area. Police say, quote, "The investigation has led us to believe that this woman may also be in danger, and is possibly afraid to come forward with information about the killings. The task force is willing to provide complete anonymity and a safe haven for her and others she may have told about the incident. There's even more of a probability that this woman has mentioned the murders to friends or other family members, but has made them assure secrecy in order to prevent her own death." Police believe that the woman would have likely been in an abusive relationship with the man. Investigators also give more of the profile of the murderer. They say, quote, "He is not an ordinary killer. He would be a neat person, but still someone who would rather wear jeans than suits. He would be very, very smart. They believe he drives a small to medium two-door vehicle, which is possibly medium blue in color with rust spots." They also believe the killer is connected to the drug world and wouldn't keep a legal job for long, but he would have a strong ability to do detailed work with his hands and mathematical skills. He is physically fit but not muscular, smooth skin and light brown-green eyes. He also has a large Adam's apple. Police say, quote, "This is a person who probably stays home a lot during the day and comes out at night. He may even stay away from home for several days, but always returns." Investigators hope that the woman will come forward and once again offer protection to her. But another year comes and goes. In June of 1995, so it's been 2 years since the murder, and police say they are still actively working the investigation. The SBI is still working the case, and Agent Dwight Ransom says, quote, "We have taken countless leads into this case. Many of them turned out to be dead ends. We've worked every lead we've been given, exhausted every single thing reported on this case, no matter how trivial the information might have been, but we have not had enough to move close enough to an arrest. The suspect or suspects may very well be in or around the area, and we firmly believe somebody knows something that may very well lead us to the suspect or suspects in this case. But the case goes cold. Years pass without an update, but investigators work behind the scenes on any leads that trickle in. The next update is in 2018, so it's been 25 years since the murders. A lot of the original investigators have retired at this point, but the case continues to puzzle them. Retired investigators now theorize that robbery was a secondary motive. The man's real intentions was to hurt people. They also question his claim that he was a police officer, something that they've done since the beginning. Quote, "It has always puzzled me that he had only one magazine for his pistol. A person trained in the military or as a police officer always carries more than one magazine. That leads me to believe he wasn't military or a police officer. All I do know is he is a cold-blooded killer." As of 2023, there have been no new updates in the case. However, there is still a $30,000 reward for information. So if you know anything about the murders of Grover Cecil, Joyce Reason, and Johnny Rankins at the B-Low grocery store in June of 1993, please call the Windsor Police at 252-794-3111 or the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation at 1-800-334-3000. So that is the unsolved case of the B-Low murders.
I thought that I had known this case or maybe heard about it prior to tonight, but I'm just glad that you brought it back to me, at least. The details of this case are so bizarre and terrifying, and I know that this case is actually a little different from ones that we've covered prior, but I'm really glad to be talking about it. And just to jump right into the timeline, that like closing shift exhaustion, while you provided, you know, great detail of what those moments were during the crime, but as someone who has worked closing shifts before, like in a store setting, this kind of scenario is something that I've played out in my own head, or just like worst case scenario where someone is still in the store. And it's terrifying to think about.
I think anyone who has, you know, worked in a retail or maybe service setting where, you know, there is a closing, you go and lock the doors. I think this kind of thing runs through a lot of people's heads. Unfortunately, it's something that we run into in the true crime world where a closing shift is kind of targeted.
That's actually the next question I had, and I have my own answers so far, but why was this place targeted? And I'm curious to know your thoughts.
I think that's a really good question. You know, police seem to feel that the suspect is an outsider, that he didn't know any of the people there. This was not like a personal vendetta against anyone. This was an attack, like almost like a random attack. But to me, there are some details that seem to suggest that this person at least studied the store a little bit to know to hide what time closing was. And he seemed to know how many men in the cleaning crew would be there. Like he anticipated four of them. So it does seem like he planned it out. But why this store? Why June? Why right now? I have no idea.
That was a similar question that popped up for me, or something that I just believed that maybe he did, which was study the store, study the closing and cleaning crew, like clock out times, arrival times, just maybe eyes on the building. But again, just, you know, begs the question, why? And I know that's the crux of this case and that it's the reason we're covering it now, but the randomness of it just really sticks out in my head.
Well, yeah, and It just doesn't really make any sense because it's like, well, if this was a robbery, why he got all the money really quickly. He didn't need to kill anybody. There was no, everybody was complying. They were doing exactly what he said. So if this was purely a robbery, why turn it into a triple murder? I mean, it seemed as if he thought he had killed five people there. So why escalate it to there when everyone was complying, everyone was listening? You know, he got everything he wanted. So why this carnage?
Yeah, the headspace he seemed to be in was chaotic and erratic, which granted, you know, you'd think that maybe most people committing crimes like this are in that headspace, but I don't know. A lot of people are very methodical and calm when they're committing crimes, especially that involve causing physical harm and or murdering multiple individuals. That's one person with a lot of power over multiple people.
Yeah, and some of the choices he makes, you know, some of them do lean towards, like, you know, he studied the store, he knew how many men in the cleaning crew to anticipate. But then at the same time, it seems like he didn't bring enough ammunition for how many people are going to be there. He didn't bring the duct tape or the dog leashes. Those were things he found in the store. So those things kind of seemed spur of the moment or chaotic in that sense, not thought out. But then other aspects of it do seem more calculated. So yeah, this case is really puzzling, trying to sort that out. Just, was this planned? Was it random? Did he study it or did he just kind of know? Like, I don't know. There's so many questions here. The FBI profile is also something that brings up a lot of questions for me because there is such specificity in their description that it almost sounds like they are describing a person that they think committed this and they are just waiting for somebody to come forward and say, like, yes, he did this. You know, to the point where it's like he, you know, drives, you know, like a two-door medium blue car with rust spots. Like, that is highly specific and seems like they are talking to somebody, you know, directly saying, we know it's you. So that's really interesting to me. I would wonder if the FBI would stand by that profile today, if they would release as much, or, you know, if that's still along the lines of who they think did it.
I think it says a lot about, you know, even the time period, how seriously they took this case. And it kind of surprised me, honestly, to see that the FBI was involved and came up with a whole profile at all, that they were able to. And the way law enforcement responded, it's so infrequent in these cases that we cover that we see, you know, law enforcement really step up. And this was a case that I feel like they did.
Yeah, you know, the local police were really up against like a horrific crime scene and something that they did not see in their day to day, or even their like year to year, something as horrific as this murder. So, you know, for them to reach out quickly to the State Bureau of Investigation and the FBI, because, you know, it did seem likely that this person crossed state lines. I think it was a really smart move to just bring like bigger forces with bigger resources into this investigation. But even with, you know, the FBI, the SBI, we're still covering this case today, even with three survivors who were able to give testimony and a really good composite sketch. We're still talking about it today because this person has not been caught.
Yeah, the fact that there are, you know, some survivors of this, I want justice so badly for this case because it's almost like he was like slipped out of their fingertips. You know what I mean? The fact that they survived and could describe this person, and it's like it's a ghost. I would love to see justice for them.
And, you know, with such a specific description, like, we know a lot of details. We know he has a bump in his nose. We know he has a large Adam's apple. You know, the description of him, what he would have looked like in 1993, I think somebody would recognize him. And, you know, police investigators feel very certain that he told somebody about this crime. People know that he committed it. So I am hopeful that, you know, so many years have passed, circumstances have changed, you know, people die, conscience gets heavy, that I am hopeful that somebody comes forward with information that they know about this case, maybe that they've known since 1993, but I hope that they come forward and just say what they know. So again, if you know anything about the murders of Grover Cecil, Joyce Reason, and Johnny Rankins at the Belo grocery store in June of 1993, please call the Windsor Police at 252-794-3111 or the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation at 1-800-334-3000. On our Instagram, we will have the suspect sketch and a picture of the Belo. This week, we don't have pictures of our victims. I was able to find a picture of Grover and his family, but it seems like the rest of the families are really looking for privacy and the survivors as well. So out of respect and since they were not readily available, I'm not including pictures of the victims of the attack, but just the suspect and the Belo grocery store, which you can see on our Instagram at Cold and Missing. If you could share that suspect sketch, just get it out there, get people looking at it. That would do huge things for this case just to get people talking about it. And we would appreciate it so much. We also have on our website transcripts of all of our episodes. So if you or someone you love is hard of hearing, you can follow along with the podcast there. It's the official transcript. So I go through, I edit, I make sure all the names are spelled correctly and everything's correct. Podcast players, I know they do transcripts now, but they're not always accurate. So if you're looking for the accurate ones, they are on our website, www.coldandmissing.com. And if you could take a minute to rate and review us in your podcast player, 5 stars goes a long way in getting this podcast into the hands of other people, into the ears of other people. So if you could rate and review us in your podcast player, it would mean a lot. And share the podcast with those in your community, people who also like true crime, like engaging with this content. Share our podcast with them. We would appreciate it oh so very much. But that is all I have for you this week. Thank you so much for listening to Cold and Missing. I'm your host, Allie.
And I'm your co-host, Eli.
Have a good week and stay safe, y'all.
Stay safe, y'all.